The host of the show asks him, well, what's going to happen if Bitcoin keeps going up? And he goes, I'll tell you what's going to happen. We're all going to die. Jim, you've seen that one. So you can always consume more if you're willing to consume capital. And that's basically what's happening with rampant capital mispricing. In the long run, you would expect most prices to fall in line with the extent to which the capital required to produce them has been invested in. I think the incentives to be massive as a company will change, and that'll probably have an effect on, you know, what the average person can invest in anyway.
This podcast is entertainment, not financial, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed represent statements of the speaker in their individual capacity, do not represent the views of Unchained, and should not be considered investment advice. Speakers often have personal, family, or business connections to Unchained, which may include direct financial benefits. Please see our disclosure at unchained.com/podcast.
Everyone, welcome back to the Bitcoin Frontier podcast. This week I have on Alan Farrington. Alan, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. Let's start off with a kind of interesting topic that people have been talking about on X. And I'll leave the first question pretty open-ended and you can take it however you wish, but is deflation a bad thing?
yes, it's horrible. What's the next question? No. So I think there's two ways you can approach this, and I have been deliberately kicking the hornet's nest, I guess. I really just for the fun of it. I don't have much else of a purpose on Twitter. I refuse to call it X, by the way, just so that your audience isn't confused. It's I'm just going to keep saying Twitter. Pretty much everything I do on Twitter is just for my own amusement. So I've been winding people up about this. So with that in mind, the simpler, funnier answer is no, which I think is good as kind of a heuristic or almost a meme, in that it just say no and just say like, nope, number go up of Bitcoin, number go down of everything else. We're all going to accumulate capital. We're all going to live in citadels. Everything's going to be amazing, blah, blah, blah. That's more effective as meme craft, and it winds up fiat apologists a lot more. Of course, underneath it, though, there is the far more complicated answer, which isn't yes, to be clear. It's basically something like, well, it's complicated, which is kind of, I feel like this is a good, maybe you might want to go into this exact topic of deflation a lot more, I suspect, but this is a good kind of summary of not only, I think, a lot of economics, but in particular, this dialogue, if you want to call it that, between Bitcoiners and, let's just call them fiat economists, I don't know what else to call them, of Bitcoiners just increasingly winding them up more and more as they get angrier and angrier about Bitcoin success, that you can always get stuck into the weeds. And maybe we probably should, just to tease it out and be a bit more intellectually serious about it. You can always get stuck in the weeds of like, oh, well, it's complicated. You know, it depends on this, depends on that. There's some nuance, there's some subtlety, blah, blah, blah. But it's a lot more fun to just be like, nope, deflation is good. Inflation is evil. You're evil. The end. Have fun staying poor.
Yeah, that's fair. Why do you think it breaks some people's brains? Like, it seems to just really...
I don't know. Well, it clearly does. I agree with you that it definitely does. Some people can compute it. I kind of hesitate to say why, because I'm always a bit... I think on the one hand, I don't really like pathologizing other people. Like, I don't know what they think, what their particular reason is. And I feel like there's almost some benefit in them saying it themselves, because either that way you maybe find some common ground and you can try to convince them, or if there really is no common ground, them saying it themselves shows just how stupid their view is, rather than it sounding like a caricature if it's coming from me. I could throw out some ideas of like, maybe some people think this without me directly attributing any particular view to anybody. I guess probably the most obvious one, this goes for many, many things besides just deflation, like anything Bitcoin touches, is just that they're not used to Bitcoin. They are used to fiat. They've only ever thought within the fiat system. And I think this is particularly pronounced when they are financial professionals as well, because it's not just like an intellectual paradigm that they've never seen broken or competed with, even. Like, they've never been presented with anything else. I mean, that's hard enough on its own if this is genuinely a new idea that you've never considered. But they start to get, that's like a starting point. That's a foundation for their resistance. But then you get layers of almost more personal animosity, because it's then getting into, well, if what I believe and have never considered anything outside of is actually bullshit, then what have I done with my life? what have I done with my entire career? And I think I always, in discussing this kind of thing, I make a point of bringing up Jesse Meyer's article, written as Croesus at the time. But oh, what's it called? Why do the yucky elite dismiss Bitcoin? Yeah. Which is just perfect. It captures this phenomenon absolutely perfectly. I won't try to recite the whole thing now. It's not even a long article in the first place. Just strongly recommend people go read that.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite articles. It kind of helped me convince myself that I was potentially right about Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I've talked to Jesse about this directly in terms of like what he thought the effect of it would be, because I find it really useful to send to people who I thought were like kind of on the fence, in who I anticipated would be on the fence, in the sense that they were clearly the yuppie elite, but I also thought that they were open-minded enough to maybe this could be like a good hook for them. But it was quite entertaining even thinking about it as to like, okay, well, where is the cutoff as to how open-minded you have to be? Because clearly at some point along the spectrum, this is going to start to offend people.
Yeah, the deflation topic also kind of reminds me of the, I think it was like Peter, I mean, I don't know his last name, but Peter Zeihan on the Joe Rogan podcast, when he was like, yeah, the price of Bitcoin is going to continue to get more expensive and it's going to go down to, you know, to negative $1,000. And Joe Rogan was like, so everything's just going to go up in terms of Bitcoin? And Peter's like, yes. And it's like the disconnect there of like, you know, price of Bitcoin's going to go up, but it's going to go to zero at the same time. I feel like a lot of people have that.
I saw a lot of the Twitter fallout of that. I haven't seen the podcast itself, or I don't think I've even seen that clip or like an extended version of that clip. I did just a couple of hours ago, I came across a classic, which I think is just like pushing this right to the extreme. I'm sure you've seen this too, where I'm guessing it's like a financial news show or something. I'm guessing it's based in Hong Kong would be my guess, because everyone on it's Chinese, even though they're speaking English. But the one guy is like, the host of the show asks him, well, what's going to happen if Bitcoin keeps going up? And he goes, I'll tell you what's going to happen. We're all going to die. Have you seen that one? But he says it with like such complete deadpan, like it's totally serious. It's like, we're all going to die. There's no other conclusion.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one. Yeah, that's funny. Sorry, the internet's kind of bad, so we'll run with it. But just so you know, I missed you on a little bit there. But from more of like a fundamental perspective, why do you think prices go down? Like when the money supply is fixed, like how are prices actually going down?
Oh sure, yeah. So in the, I guess, the simplest model possible, where you're like, you're just holding as much equal as you can. And I'll come back to that, because that's how the fiat apologists wriggle their way out of this. You're just holding as much as you can constant. Every business entrepreneur, maybe more to the point, is always incentivized anyway to invest, regardless of what the the properties of the money are. The question is, well, if it's sound money, does this increase this incentive? And I would argue it does. So you're always incentivized to invest. The point being that the end goal of investment is to try to create a good or a service that you'll eventually sell, either more cheaply than is currently available, or that is just better than what's currently available, or that's entirely new. So it's not comparable to anything that's currently available at all. But the assumption would always be that, you know, unless this is, there might be some weird corner cases where you're doing this purely with your own time. Maybe art fits that bill if you're like a writer, or you know, you're a composer or something like that. But actually, even in that case, now that I'm saying that, time is a resource. Time's probably the most important resource. And that same principle as to, okay, well, what are you going to allocate your time and your resources towards applies in just increasingly complicated forms to any entrepreneur. The resources will obviously get more involved. Time is, I guess, is somewhat, I don't know, abstract. You don't usually think of that in purely economic terms. It's, to the extent you do, you usually characterize it as money, right? But then even that gets more involved. And probably the easiest way to understand something like this would be physical machinery in a factory, right? So, you know, you can only make X many widgets per hour if you're doing it by hand. But if you instead put some of the time into building this machine, then it goes up to 1,000 per whatever. And that cost you some time in the interim where you weren't doing it at 100, but now you're doing it at 1,000. And so then either just to come full circle, I guess, directly get this into being an answer to the question. Now that you can do 1,000 rather than 100, you can lower the price. So you can still make a profit, but take market share by lowering the price. And so that ultimately is how you would expect all prices to, well, I shouldn't say all, in the long run, you would expect most prices to fall in line with the extent to which the capital required to produce them has been invested. And so ultimately, again, there's a lot of things that we're holding constant here, but if the price signals around the merits of making the investment in the first place are, let's say, clear enough, you know, uninterrupted with, yes, you would just expect investment naturally because it's to the advantage of the entrepreneur to invest. And so the extent to which they're successful at investing will ultimately cause deflation.
Yeah, exactly. I guess a lot of the fiat type economists just get confused with the credit contraction side of deflation and not realize So interesting. From like their perspective as well, do you think that there's ever been or even still is like some malintention of saying that deflation is bad? Like, is it a cabal of central bankers or bankers that are like just trying to, you know, be close to the money printer? Or is it just at this point, it's just been like, you know, passed down for years and that's just how the world works and people are just...
I think it's partly that it's been passed down, and that's why it's so funny to poke people on this, because you get into like, oh, I cannot compute, deflation is bad. I don't think it's really a conspiracy though. I mean, I think I have a pretty clear idea of where this idea comes from. And you touched on it a second ago, but it's definitely worth teasing out. It's what happens when a credit bubble collapses. And so the high level summary of this would basically be something like, there are scenarios in which, I'm not even going to say deflation is bad. It's more deflation is happening and everything else that's happening is bad. And the connection that they make is, oh, well, therefore deflation must be bad, in particular because in an inflationary system, that's the only time they ever see deflation, right? Everything else, whether in the, you know, the boom prior to the bust, that's full of inflation. The recovery from the, which is kind of the beginning of the next boom, I guess, the recovery from the next bust is fueled by inflation. So the only time they ever see deflation is when everything is as bad as it can possibly be or ever is. And so they misattribute the deflation as somehow constituting the badness, when in fact, both the badness and the very temporary deflation is the consequence of, I would say just inflation is a bit more specific than that. It's a consequence of the repricing of capital following a realization that the extension of credit has been completely unsustainable. And so
in this frontier moment, Alan is talking about the deflation boogeyman. Let's look at several regions in the 1800s that experienced economic growth alongside very low inflation or even deflation. One, during the British Industrial Revolution, technological advances increased productivity and lowered production costs, leading to a massive economic expansion without serious inflation. Two, in the United States post-Civil War Gilded Age, rapid industrialization and technological progress, particularly in railroads and steel, contributed to considerable wealth generation with relatively stable consumer prices, basically no inflation. Three, France's Belle Époque was marked by cultural and technological progress with stable living standards and controlled relatively low inflation. During this time, these economies were under some form of gold or silver standard, and they had new forms of innovation and production, which helped lower prices over time. It's interesting to note that even under a gold or silver standard, there was still some monetary supply inflation as more gold and silver was mined each year. Under a Bitcoin standard with no monetary supply inflation and the modern speed of technology innovation, prices may fall even faster. And now back to Alan.
Give a bit more detail about exactly what's happening there. Basically, the reason that you would get deflation in this circumstance is that at some point, the credit bubble pops, right? So basically, everybody realizes, oh, you know, we've consumed far more than we've produced. We've borrowed far more than we ever intend to repay. also crucially, there is kind of an assumption that it's not just inflation in the sense of money printing, but it's increased leverage. So it's money printing in particular in the form of credit extension by commercial banks, which is basically how the fiat system works. And so not only is the money supply gone up, is there more money in circulation, but many, many more both individual assets, but ultimately also the money itself is intrinsically levered. So people have these assets that the face value of the asset, or you know, the market value where they to try to liquidate it, is actually dependent on the value of some other asset via leverage, and then that's dependent on something else via leverage. And this is when you know it's great when this is going up, because people are just, you know, they borrow against some asset, and then that creates a new asset, they borrow against that, and this continues and everybody feels great. When this collapses though, then you get this, it's usually called either just a debt spiral, or in particular a debt deflationary spiral. And so this is where the deflation comes in, because at the point in time at which it collapses, and for some short period thereafter, there is some amount of goods that are in their final state of production, right? They've been made, they've gone through the production process, they've gone through all the probably largely misallocated capital, popped out as consumer goods, but they're not yet sold. And they exist, they're on the market, but all of a sudden nobody wants to buy anything anymore, because nobody has any idea how much wealth they even have. Because again, not only their assets, but even their money, because the money is ultimately a bank liability, they don't know if it's worth anything. And so in order to clear the market, the merchants who have these goods need to dramatically drop the price. And so this is basically where the fiat economists come in, because this is the only time they ever see prices falling. And they're like, oh, that's deflation. That's terrible. This is all terrible, but this in particular is terrible. And so that's the debt deflationary spiral. Their solution is obviously to recapitalize. I was going to say everybody. It's really more banks. Recapitalize banks, recapitalize everybody who has these toxic loans by turning on the money printer, and then we get back into inflation and eventually everybody's happy again. And then they look back on like, oh, remember when we briefly had deflation? That was so bad. Let's never do that again.
Yeah, I really like this perspective, because it also kind of gives me comfort, like why the yuppie elite dismiss Bitcoin. I understand like where they're coming from. I think they're like kind of wrong at the end of the day. They're confused by what's actually causing the problem, or what actually is the problem. But it's comforting to know that like, oh, this is their perspective, but I can see why they're wrong. And that makes me more confident in Bitcoin, I guess. And like the future of deflation. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Under a Bitcoin standard, do you think economic growth would accelerate? Do you think it would slow? Do you think it would be about the same? How do you think about that?
I'm not sure entirely how to answer, because I don't like the idea of economic growth. And I mean, in some senses I do. I don't mean to be too pedantic about this, but it's maybe more the way of measuring it I don't like. So the way of measuring it that is, you know, completely mainstream now is, I would argue, is highly tied to all of these fiat misconceptions in a couple of ways. I probably won't go through all of these, because it's a little bit tangential to what you're asking. I'll come back to like, what do I think would happen in Bitcoin? I think the crucial flaw in terms of what is being, they're basically measuring the wrong thing. They don't realize that they're measuring the wrong thing. They're measuring consumption. That's in a kind of a macroeconomic aggregate sense. You could think of it as, if you want to think of it more in like an accounting sense, they're basically measuring revenue, right? Where there's two problems with that. So one is that it's, first of all, you need to shift it to profit, because it's profit that actually matters, right? If you're consuming, but everybody's making a loss on their consumption, that's not a good thing, right? That means that resources are yes, they're being consumed, but they're being consumed inefficiently. So you want them to be consumed as efficiently as possible, which means you want profit to be as high as possible. That's problem number one. But then problem number two is that even profit doesn't really tell you anything about what's happening over time. It tells you what's happening in one particular moment. But what you really want is returns, right? You want to know of these profits, what is available to then be reinvested into the capital base that is what actually allows us to create the revenues and the profits in the first place. So the entire outlook is just deeply confused, basically. And it leads to, I mean, that maybe might sound kind of almost too intellectual to be to be useful, like very abstract, very intangible. I think I have a pretty good, it's not even an example, it's just like a way of thinking about that that grounds it a bit more helpfully, which is that if you don't care about returns, right, or never mind even caring about profits, right, you don't care about returns, you only care about revenue, you can always boost revenue, or I guess it's maybe even easier to understand in the macroeconomic context, you can always consume more if you're willing to consume capital. And that's basically what's happening with rampant capital mispricing with, this is now going down a separate rabbit hole, but we kind of covered that already, right? That this is when you stimulate the economy, that's basically what you're doing. You're encouraging people to consume by effectively giving them, we'll call it misinformation, because that's kind of a weird, almost meme of its own in a separate context at this point, but it's you're giving them incorrect economic information about state of economic reality to trick them into consuming things that haven't actually been produced. And this is just clearly not good. So if that's your measure of economic growth, then I just don't care. I don't want to maximize that. It's not even that I want to minimize it. It's just, you're just measuring the wrong. What you should be measuring is something like returns. But then that gets super interesting as well, because for reasons it's probably not worth going into, it's much more difficult, if not actually impossible, to measure that. Maybe that'll then get into actually finally answering the question. What do I think will happen with Bitcoin, right? Like, why will this be different? I'm not sure you'd even, on kind of a day-to-day level, I'm not sure you'd notice that much different. I think you need to look over longer and longer time horizons as to how the difference plays out, because everybody's individual incentives are still the same. And if anything, this I think is the problem, maybe even you could say the evil of fiat, is that it's not that any individual is behaving badly. It's that everybody has the wrong information and acts contrary to what they actually think is in their interest and actually reflects economic reality that they're getting this information from. So day to day, you probably wouldn't notice that much of a difference. But first of all, you certainly wouldn't get wild booms and busts in credit cycles. Maybe something we can come back to, that I don't at all think that means there won't be credit. I think there almost certainly will be credit. There'll just be significantly less than now, because the risks will have to be, the pricing will reflect the risks appropriately. And that will affect who's willing to supply that capital in the first place, as opposed to just making it up, basically, which is what commercial banks do currently. So it's not that there won't be any credit, but there won't be credit-fueled manias. And maybe the flip side of that, in terms of what consumers are actually seeing, is that there will be more and more of an incentive to invest in things that are intrinsically long-term in the first place. So aiming for the consumer good at the end of the production process to either be super far removed, because there's lots and lots of intermediate steps, or basically to like not be garbage, to not be consumable garbage, to be higher quality. And that's super interesting. And that leads to all kinds of things that are like barely even about economics. They're more social concerns. But I think over the longer and longer term, those are the kinds of differences that you would come to expect.
Gotcha. So like, would you agree with this? Like, price signals would be a lot more accurate, and therefore investments might be a lot more accurate or a lot more helpful. It wouldn't be consuming like capital. And therefore, more innovation might occur because those price signals are more accurate. Maybe not more growth, but more like helpful innovation. Do you agree with that or disagree?
With tax day on April 15th, high net worth Bitcoin holders could be leaving a lot of money on the table if they don't have a sound financial plan and tax strategy. Sound Advisory is a leading financial advisory firm for long-term Bitcoin holders like yourself. They can help you maximize your Bitcoin wealth while navigating the complexities of the legacy financial system. Don't get killed on taxes. Check out Sound Advisory at thesoundadvisory.com for more information. That's thesoundadvisory.com. Now back to the show.
I think I agree with the spirit of that. Yeah, I think you should be a little bit pedantic. You have to be careful with how you're qualifying this. So I'm not sure it's really possible to qualify it as better, because it's all counterfactual, right? It's relative to what? Well, relative to some alternate history that didn't happen. And I guess you kind of have to, if you don't want to be, you know, moralizing about it, which maybe you do, I don't know, but I guess it kind of ceases to be economics at that point. I don't really see any coherent way of assessing that other than just whatever the market decides. So this almost comes right back to the question itself, in that the appropriate way to, you know, gauge what is better or worse is, it's not to point to a particular outcome as being good or bad, because basically who are you to say that? It's everyone who has to determine that by all going to the market and acting, but rather what information are people getting that is informing their decisions, you know, as to what they value. And so I think that's all, like, obviously the clear difference. And it's kind of weird to think about it. It's like, I often struggle with coming up with, you know, good analogies for this, because to my mind, it's not even that Bitcoin is like good, quote unquote. It's more just that it's not bad, right? It's that fiat introduces all kinds of misinformation and all kinds of malincentives. And I'm not even sure that there's such a thing as like good information or good incentives. It's just getting rid of this, like flushing it out is what we're aiming for here.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's a great point. This is another idea that you kind of brought up earlier, is kind of related to technology deflation, and I want to hear your thoughts about it. I've kind of started thinking about Bitcoin as like an asset that somewhat protects investors from like the natural processes of creative destruction and innovation. Like if you hold a bunch of gold and AI discovers a cheap way to extract gold from the ocean, then gold holders are going to get debased and potentially lose wealth from that. Or like if NVIDIA, you know, is currently making GPUs at $500 and can sell them for $30,000, and an entrepreneur or some other innovative person can do it cheaper, then wealth in NVIDIA is at risk. Would you view also like Bitcoin as a way to like kind of opt out or protect yourself from the natural forces of creative destruction? Or would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I think that sounds right. I kind of think there's a simpler way of describing, you know, the phenomenon that you're pointing at, though, which is just that it is better money, I think, because that's really what if you're anticipating, you know, like we mine asteroids for gold or something. I think that individual, you know, scenario doesn't really matter so much as, well, how scarce is gold really? So that's on the one hand that, and I don't think Bitcoin is above that, by the way. I mean, it could be that this is kind of a cliche. This isn't original at all, but there could be some bug that we just don't know about, right? Or actually, there's bugs we do know about that haven't been fixed yet, and maybe we just never get the consensus to fix them, and then it just breaks eventually. Like there are things like that. Or there's also like getting a bit more kind of sci-fi, almost, you know, to the point of delusional. There's like, well, what if quantum computing breaks the hashing algorithm or something like that, which I don't believe in at all, by the way. But you can come up with these scenarios, right? The other one you mentioned, though, this I think is way more interesting, that it was like NVIDIA, but it's basically any company you want to actively invest in. Yes, Bitcoin definitely gives you a new option. But again, I'm sort of struggling to think of how to describe it, because it's really just money. It's like, well, money should actually be in the first place. So again, we don't have this with fiat, but that's only because fiat sucks, right? It's because fiat has bad money that you don't have this option that you should have. So it's not even really that Bitcoin's that good. It's just Bitcoin's normal. You know, Bitcoin is what Bitcoin represents is kind of what just should be the case. And you shouldn't have to think about this. You should be able to distinguish between saving and investing rather than needing to invest in order to effectively save. That maybe is the best way of tackling the NVIDIA comparison, or you know, again, any investment, any company that you're buying the cash flows of.
Yeah, I agree with that. Here's another question that I'm curious to kind of hear your thoughts on. If, you know, there is a such thing as a S&P 500 passive index fund on a Bitcoin standard, you know, like say the top 500 companies in the US, where do you think that would trend over time? Like, you know, obviously today in dollar terms, it trends up forever. And under a Bitcoin standard, would it also trend up forever? Would it go sideways, yeah, or down? How do you think about
this? This is a super interesting question. I've wondered about this a little bit. I'm not sure you can predict this. I think there's two interesting concerns. So one is that, again, it's funny how many times we're coming back to this. It's like, fiat just corrupts this completely. So what happens if fiat is wrong? It's not even that what happens if Bitcoin is right. It certainly shouldn't go up forever. I'm not even sure if I can explain off the top of my head why it shouldn't go up forever. Probably something like, this is maybe a bit simplistic, I think that you'd need to iron this out, like iron out the details of this in the background. But the total value of all deployed capital. What's even the best way of putting this? The total value of all deployed capital shouldn't be rising in monetary terms, because it should be rising in real term. Effectively, because anytime you deploy capital, if you're finding a market for it at all, you're taking that consumption away from something else. But the not only the assumption, but I guess it's kind of by definition true, you're improving the options that are available to the consumer. And so this maybe ties interestingly to the previous question one of the previous questions, that this is what you should be looking for rather than just the number go up of growth, right? It's not just the revenues going up, it's that the choices that consumers have are getting better and better. And that's kind of tricky to wrap your head around. I think this is like, this definitely taps into the whole, you know, the fiat apologist mindset. And like, what are you talking about? The S&P can't go up. Like, of course it goes up. If it goes up, that's good. All it really means that the S&P is going up is like you're witnessing the Cantillon effect in real time. It's like the Cantillon graph, basically, because that excess is money that's going to the financial sector just because of the mechanism of money, the predominant mechanism of money creation. It's money that's going to the financial sector first and then eventually trickles down to everybody else. So yeah, point number one would be that I think all else equal, you would just you'd expect deflation, basically, right? So you'd expect the monetary value of your, if you're thinking of it passively, right? So it's like the entire index to stay the same, but the dividends that you're getting, which is ultimately obviously the point of any kind of investment in an equity, to buy you more and more. Obviously within that, loads of individual companies will go up and down, and that's a good thing. But what that really represents is the shifting share of the end consumer's purchases to whoever is providing the most value. I think that's the key insight, rather than just everybody, you know, everything going up, right? So that's point number one. So that would seem to suggest it should stay level. I think there's another interesting one though, and I just think this is impossible to predict. I mean, maybe someone else has a better idea of how you would predict this, but you would also get into a question of how many companies need to be public in the first place. And I suspect it's fewer. But I'm really not sure about that, because where I'm coming from with that answer is that I definitely suspect the average size of a company will be much, much smaller. But does that mean that they necessarily don't go public? Maybe they do. Like maybe it's not the maybe S&P 500 doesn't become useful anymore. It needs to, there already is, I forget what they're called, but is it like the Russell 3000 or something? Like we just need a much wider index to actually capture, you know, what matters economically. So yeah, I don't know. This is kind of like arguing on technicalities that aren't really relevant to the question, but just in terms of fully answering the question, I do think that's interesting that I think the incentives to be massive as a company will change, and that'll probably have an effect on, you know, what the average person can invest in anyway.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. Another like very related topic that I've been thinking about a little bit is like company life cycle. Like I feel like markets are becoming more efficient and technology is accelerating. So there could be more and more disruptions and people could get, you know, booted out rather fast. Like NVIDIA could have an edge today, but then, you know, some other AI creates this new technology and all of a sudden they can create GPUs at much cheaper prices. But then I also see like Bitcoin, where it's like, if you put like Saylor, if he puts Bitcoin in his balance sheet, you might be able to last, MicroStrategy might be able to last for centuries, you know? So like, how do you think about that?
I think the MicroStrategy example is confusing and probably not helpful to think about too seriously, because it's obviously transient, right? Like it can, which is why it's so good, right? Well, for holders of MicroStrategy, I guess it's like they're taking advantage of, I think it's fair to call it arbitrage almost. It's like an arbitrage of understanding and the pricing of various sources of capital. But the essence of the trade that Saylor is making is that you can only make it now. Like you can only do it one time, right? You can only make it now. At some point it'll have paid off and then Bitcoin will just be money. Again, this is leading to like what I don't think is a terribly interesting answer to the question. It's just more truthful, I guess, that at you know, hyper Bitcoinization, if you want to call it that, when this is in fact just money, probably the best thing for MicroStrategy to do is just return it all to investors. Because I mean, this is a fairly standard thing in just corporate finance, like not fiat corporate finance, just corporate finance, like totally straightforward corporate finance, that companies should only really have as much cash on their balance sheet as they need to opportunistically invest themselves, or weather whatever volatility they have in their own cash flows. That's obviously a, let's say, a subjective question. It's up to the prudence and discernment of the management of the company, of, you know, of every company, to decide what's appropriate in their circumstances. But by and large, they shouldn't just be stockpiling cash. Like, it does, it just doesn't really make any sense from a capital allocation perspective. And so that's why I think the MicroStrategy example is actually kind of confusing right now, because in the long run, it won't make any sense.
Company lifecycle, ignoring the MicroStrategy example, would you expect it to get shorter or longer because of advancing creative destruction, et cetera?
Oh, that's super interesting. Yeah. Again, I'm not sure. I can think of reasons kind of pulling in both directions. Yeah, I don't have a good answer on this at all. I'll throw some stuff out. Maybe it's interesting for people to think about. But on the one hand, you might be tempted to think it'll be longer just because the overall incentives are more towards long-termism, right? Investment projects will, not in any kind of deterministic sense, maybe I shouldn't say they will, but the incentives for investment projects will be more skewed towards having longer-term goals in the first place. So you might be tempted to think that companies will last longer as a result. At the same time, though, you might think about unwinding some of the, you know, the maladies of fiat in terms of keeping companies alive way longer than they should be, you know, way longer than is, you know, than the market is desperately trying to tell them. So I could also imagine that there'll be kind of a simpler process for companies just folding when it's determined that, you know, they're no longer capable of investing above their cost of capital, basically, which this leads back to a couple of questions from a while ago. I won't spend too long on this, but just that like yet another way of thinking about the capital misallocation in fiat and ultimately the effect it has on prices too, the consumer prices, you know, the end prices at the conclusion of the productive process, is that companies who are, again, actually potentially unprofitable, right? Like, have poor or non-existent returns on the basis of their revenue, nonetheless continue to receive financing because that financing itself is not appropriately priced, right? As long as they can continue to extract interest by continuing to pump revenues, it doesn't matter to an extent, right? They're not, you know, in not like it's, you know, completely inelastic or anything, but way above what would actually happen in a in an uninterfered with market. These companies are just kept alive by mispriced financing. So if you take that out, you'd maybe be tempted to think the life cycle will be shorter as well. So I don't know where this nets out. And there might be more reasons I haven't thought of.
Yeah, that was just a question I've been thinking about a little bit. I know, kind of shifting topics a little bit, I know Dhruv and I think you as well have been thinking about this idea of like the internet and AI and other things being eventually built on Bitcoin or being built on like decentralized markets in general. What does that mean? And can you dive into more detail there?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think I shouldn't say too much about this because this is more Drew's thing. And I it's more like I've been prompting him to like, we need to write more of this down. We need to get it out there. I should say, I don't know when you're going to release this, but in the not too distant future, we have a paper on this coming out. I mean, it's not only on this, it's actually more on, so Dhruv and Ryan Gentry gave an amazing talk, still probably one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Bitcoin talks that I've ever seen, like presentations at a conference, in 2021, I think, in Miami. Is a while ago now. And at a much higher level than how you framed the question, it's basically around, it's like the very sort of polite case for Bitcoin, not crypto, right? But by polite, I mean sort of the most assuming good faith, like they don't use the word scammer, they don't say shitcoin, that, you know, assuming that everybody involved in crypto really has the best intentions, which I think there's a lot of merit to. I don't know how, you know, far down that rabbit hole you want to go. There's a lot of scammers, but I think for the most part, yeah, the people probably are well-intentioned. They think they're building useful things or things that will at some point be useful. But Ryan and Dhruv's argument is, you know, if you really think through what the foundation of this technology is, it's probably wiser to try to build this on Bitcoin. It'll be harder and it'll take longer. And, you know, maybe leaning a bit more into the scamming angle you won't be able to get rich immediately by issuing a token, but the flip side of that is kind of the same thing from a different angle, I guess. You'll have to create real wealth, right? You'll also have the opportunity to create real wealth. You won't be incentivized into these sort of token crypto economic shenanigans. So that was the genesis of this paper, was adapting that talk. But we've pushed it a bit further now, given first of all, Noster has emerged. So we talk a little bit about that in the context of, the methodology that we're analyzing Bitcoin and Lightning with. And then obviously Drew's also done a lot of thinking in the meantime on AI. That really is more his thing. I don't want to ignorantly comment on that.
Yeah, fair. I guess thinking about building decentralized systems, what would that have, like what effect would that have from like an economics perspective? Would that just accelerate like the deflationary, effects on prices within the economy, and like would more wealth be accruing to Bitcoin?
That's a good question. I feel like I don't really have a good answer to this either. Again, there's a couple of things that come to mind, but I really don't have much conviction in how it nets out. One thing that is actually kind of tied, it's not something that we explicitly mention in the paper. I don't think they explicitly mention it in the talk either, but it's clearly kind of it's in the spirit of what we're talking about, that I think it's worth being as humble as possible and as disciplined as possible about how much can in fact be decentralized in the first place, and also what you even mean by that. I think I have a feel for what you mean by that, so I'm not accusing you of this mistake, but I'm very much accusing a huge number, a huge proportion of crypto proponents of making varieties of this mistake, where to use some of the language that Drew and Ryan actually came up with originally, but we've brought into this paper as well, that they're doing kind of cargo cult innovation. So they're lifting from Bitcoin what it seems like the innovation is, which is the blockchain, but because they don't understand what the actual innovation is and what is worth trying to copy and what is worth trying to extend. And so I think this is kind of dying down now, if I'm completely honest. It seems like finally it is, that the seriousness is kind of coalescing around Bitcoin, but certainly in 2017, 18, so ICO bubble, and then you kind of get a repeat of this in 21 in the DeFi bubble, where I'd say the field has narrowed to now mostly being about finance, but the magnitude of capital being thrown at it has increased more than enough to make up for everything else that's fallen off. But in both of those bubbles, you do have this element of, oh, we're going to decentralize everything. What they mean by everything changes. And so I do just think you need to be careful about that. It may be that, there's so little you can actually apply this methodology to, that in the scheme of things, it's not much beyond Bitcoin, or not, let's say, money and payments and finance to some extent, that really ends up being impacted. I mean, on the flip side of that, this is also kind of cliche too, that money is half of every trade. So in a way, everything ends up impacted, but more just in terms of like being kind of pumping the brakes a bit on the hype around blockchain technology. I think I'm keen to get that message out.
So you published a funny satirical screenshot of your DLC VM paper. Yeah. What's funny about it for those that may be confused about it on Twitter? I saw some people were like, hey, is this a joke?
I feel kind of conflicted in whether to answer this or how to answer it at all. So on the one hand, I'm tempted to completely stay in character and be like, no, it's deadly serious. This is the innovation to end all innovations. I don't think I could do that though. I could do it in writing. I couldn't keep a straight face on video. And another part of me kind of wants to say, well, it's not up to me to say what's funny. It's up to whoever found it funny to say what, or maybe whoever fell for it to say what's funny. I don't know. How do I even go about answering this? I mean, it's basically just a hoax. Like that's, I don't think there's much more to say to it than that. It's like, I had this hunch, which proved to be completely correct, that if I wrote this in a particular enough style and used enough buzzwords, that people would take it seriously, completely regardless of the content. And so that, just in case the audience isn't familiar with what we're talking about, the content of this idea is like so dumb that it's funny. I find it funny at first. I find it funny enough to like turn it into an entire paper. But So the idea that is actually being proposed. So basically what this paper actually says, if you read it and you make an effort to understand it without being distracted by all the nonsense, right, is that we can scale Bitcoin as follows. Not just we can scale Bitcoin, sorry. We can be done with scale. Like scaling is finished. I've solved it, right? We can scale Bitcoin to as many, you know, as high throughput as you want. And not just that, but the scripting as well can be as expressive as you want. It can be, you know, whether you want to call it Turing complete, or the Ethereum guys always bring up that, you know, they never really meant Turing complete. They meant it's rich statefulness that really matters. Like whatever, we can make Bitcoin do any computation you want. And here's how we do it. Oh, I with no soft forks either. That's the really cool part, right? I'm not proposing any kind of new opcode or anything. You take the computation that you want to do, right, and then you set up a DLC VM. I'm so used to saying that. You set up a DLC where you have n, it's like arbitrarily high number, possible spend paths of this DLC, which correspond to every possible output of this computation. Which sounds a bit nuts, but remember, only one of these ever hits the chain. This is serious, right? In terms of how DLC actually works, you pre-compute as many possible outcomes as you want. But there's no block space issue, right? Only one of them will ever go live. And then, so you have all your pre-signed, pre-committed outputs of the of what this computation could result in, and you set it up as a DLC, and then you get the oracle to run the computation, and then they tell you the result, and then you put it on chain, and so you can compute anything you want, anything at all. And that's scaling salt, right? So that's what the paper actually says. If you read it and, you know, I was take it seriously, I guess, yeah, if you take it seriously and you discern what is it I'm proposing. But I basically proposed it in such a ridiculous way with so much kind of, I can give examples of this if you want to get even more stuck into it, but so much like pompous, conceptualizations of what I'm talking about. And even the framing is ridiculous because section one is called What is a Computer? And it's like a philosophical mini essay on like what it means to compute things, which for no reason at all. It's funny.
In this frontier moment, Alan is talking about his satirical paper on Bitcoin scaling. As he described, he was kind of poking fun at how the community sometimes falls for big buzzwords and nothing of serious value. But let's look at this paper and identify some funny parts. First, the subtitle. Generalized Unboundedly Scalable Computation on Bitcoin. Bitcoin has a block size limit that makes Bitcoin full nodes cheap and easy to run. This is what keeps Bitcoin decentralized and gives no central group the ability to change the rules. This block size limit obviously has serious limitations. It bounds scalability on the first layer, so anything that turns this finite space into infinite unbounded space likely has obvious trade-offs. The trade-offs involved are oracles, which is a trusted third party. So sure, you can scale Bitcoin by putting trusted third parties in charge of certain coins, but that's not really scaling Bitcoin in a decentralized manner. It's just a playful joke. On Twitter, I've even played this game by congratulating BlackRock on their new Bitcoin L2, the ETF, as a joke. Last, what is a computer is just too abstract to really mean much, but it's definitely kind of funny. So pause this video if you want to read the whole introduction, but otherwise, let's get back to Alan.
But yeah, it worked. Like it turns out that you can, which we sort of knew this anyway, like there's plenty of other examples outside of Bitcoin, but it turns out even within Bitcoin, you can propose complete nonsense, but if you say it in the right way, people will take it seriously. So that is DLCVM. And I'm kind of sad I'm now on record saying that because I tried to keep up the joke for a long time, but... I know he's talking about it anymore anyway. So that was its own fun little weekend of occupying my time when I should have been doing something in the real world.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, do you think it's like kind of concerning that like so many people were like, oh my gosh, like this was an actual breakthrough. Like this is crazy. Like it seems a little concerning to me.
Not really. Well, why are you concerned? I'll see if I agree or not.
I guess just like thinking about, you know, maybe Bitcoin Twitter isn't really that smart, but I think generally speaking, you know, people are pretty smart, and like, you know, people write code in like Bitcoin, like we talked about earlier, like it's possible that there's a bug in Bitcoin. And if like smart people are interacting with you on Twitter with this thing and saying like, oh my gosh, like this is a breakthrough, or like there's flaws with this, blah, 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 like taking you seriously. It seems like there could be flaws, you know, elsewhere that are like very important that, you know.
Yeah, I think I do disagree with this. I think you're misidentifying the source of why, not why the paper is funny, but why the reaction is funny. I think the reaction is funny because I don't think it says anything at all about Bitcoin Twitter or like the Bitcoin community or anything. I think it maybe says something just about the individuals they were fooling. But I tell you what, there is a really interesting way of interpreting some of the reactions to this. So I'd say broadly there were three reactions. I have no idea what the proportion of them were, but I noticed these and they're all quite distinct. So one is, oh my God, this is an amazing breakthrough, which is obviously retarded. One is the getting it, right? We're like, haha, this is funny. But there's a third one, which I think is the best. The fact that this exists, I think, disproves your point the best. So there's people who were like, this is so dumb. Like, if you're trusting the Oracle, like basically arguing, like they get it, but they also don't get it's a joke, right? And that was the funniest thing. When I started arguing with these people in character, I won't say who they are. They know who they are. You can probably find out who they are quite easily. But they're like, but if you're trusting the Oracle, then how is this a breakthrough? Like, you may as well just use a multisig. And then I'd be like, oh my God, yes, that's you just made it even better. Like, imagine if we had more than one Oracle and we had a multisig and it could be like Frost and you could have threshold signatures. Oh, it'd be so cool. And then they'd argue with that. And then, so the point I'm making, though, is that I think the fact that that exists is itself encouraging because they clearly didn't waste any actual time or effort. Like, they did understand it. It's more, and then you got the people who just fell for it. But I think even that's worth digging into, because the people who fell for it, there's no way that they reached the same understanding as the ones who like got it literally but didn't realize it was a joke. I think they were just bamboozled by all the buzzwords and the pompous presentation and everything. I actually don't think so. I think it's worthwhile breaking out these categories, and then obviously the people who got it is also like, yeah, good for them. I think breaking out those categories is important in realizing that, or at least theorizing that, I literally don't think there's anybody who actually wasted time on this. I think there's people who either realized it was stupid but didn't realize it was a joke, or didn't realize it was stupid, if you see what I mean. That's my theory, having, you know, basked in this for a week or two or whenever I even did it. I forget. I think it was 3 weeks ago now.
Yeah, that's a good point. There were people that I remember reading through the replies that actually were like, wait, they understood kind of what you're going at. And they like, yeah, like, wait, this is stupid. You're just, you're trusting an Oracle, which is defeats the purpose of this. But yeah, that's a good point. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this one. This is actually a question from Dhruv at Unchained. Do you see yourself as like a technical thinker, a political thinker, an economic thinker in Bitcoin? Like, how would you like characterize?
Interesting. I mean, definitely not technical. No, I mean, I would, there's a couple of points probably worth making there. I absolutely would not want anyone to believe something technical because I said it. Like, that would be horrifying to me, that I'm, you know, abusing my influence or whatever to the extent I have any. So yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think of myself that. I try not to talk that way either. And I kind of, that's even maybe relates to why DLCM is so funny. It's like, why would I have, like, if you actually know who I am as well, like, why would I have come up with something like this? As opposed to just shitposting, which is exactly what I'm known for. So yeah, there's that. I mean, that's not to say I'm, you know, like completely technically illiterate. I think given my job, also just intellectual interest, like I do try to be relatively technically literate. You know, I only have so much time to get really into the weeds on some of these things. But I don't think of myself that way. No. I think, to be honest, the only thing, like, I'm interested in a lot of things that are frequently discussed on, whether it's Bitcoin Twitter or like the Bitcoin community, to the extent you think there's such a thing. Honestly, the only thing that I really think I have any expertise in, it would be around finance, not even economics, because the economic side I just find like intellectually interesting, stimulating. I mean, it's interesting to me more for the reasons we discussed a while ago as to why, you know, mainstream economists are just wrong about everything. Like, that is sort of funny and depressing in its own right, and worth tackling and worth kind of being aware of if you're navigating the collapse of fiat, right? But I'm not an economist, right? I don't refer to myself that way. I don't do any work that's relevant in that realm. So it's really only finance where I would actually put myself forward in, as an expert, and I would actually argue with people about things with some credibility rather than just shitposting, basically.
Yeah, that's fair. I definitely think you are a finance expert. Another question, we have two more and then we'll close it out. If there was ever an Alan Farrington podcast, what would it be about? Who would your first three guests be?
Oh, that's interesting. So I had this idea originally as a joke, but then the more I talked to people about it, the more I felt maybe we should actually do it. And it involves Dhruv as well, which is maybe why he asked this question. I think he's like planting for me to flatter him in reply. The joke idea I had was that me, Dhruv, and Giacomo Zucco should do a podcast. And basically we'd rug the audience completely because they would think it was about Bitcoin. We'd maybe even put Bitcoin in the title just to make it extra confusing. And all we would actually do is just argue about like math and physics and computer science, which if you know who all three of us are, will hopefully make sense, you know, why that would be entertaining. But the idea came from the fact that I actually don't know if or how well Dhruv and Giacomo know each other, but I know them both pretty well. And I've had, I wouldn't say arguments exactly, but quite involved discussions with both of them about, so my academic background is in math and Dhruv's is in physics, and Giacomo's is, I believe his PhD is actually in math, but he thinks of himself more as like a computer scientist. And obviously we have enough background to talk about all of them intelligently. But I've had really involved discussions with both of them about these topics for reasons that originated in Bitcoin, like usually something that they said on a podcast or like tweeted or whatever, but then went completely off, well, not off topic, off the topic of Bitcoin and into the actual academic context. And it had just happened so many times that I thought it would be funny to have a podcast around that setup where like you think it's going to be about Bitcoin, but it's just not. Like we just never talk about Bitcoin at all. Or like the first minute is about Bitcoin because we say the origin of the problem that we're then going to argue about, but then we just never mention Bitcoin again. So I think that would be quite funny. I don't know if we'd even need guests if we just have like episodes where we change what we're arguing about every time. But I'd do that. I might actually do that. It started as a joke, but the more I talk about it, the better the reaction the people I'm saying it to give. And it's kind of like memeing itself into reality at this point.
Well, you should. I would tune in. I think it'd be a great, great, funny podcast. Last question, then we can close it out. What's something that you believe that most Bitcoiners would disagree with?
Oh, that's interesting. I think of a few things, actually. So most of which we've touched on at some point in this chat. So we have a bit of context for it. So one is actually, I brought this up in the context of the paper and Ryan and Drew's talk. I think I have a far higher opinion of almost everybody involved in crypto ex Bitcoin than almost all Bitcoiners do. I have kind of an interesting reason for that though, which is that I have this theory as to like how the crypto industry works. I won't go into the whole thing now. I'll just give you like the very high level of it, which is that it's all driven by financiers, I guess you'd say. And as in that the malevolent actions of financiers are upstream of everything else. And I think that whether it's entrepreneurs or developers or academics, even like users, I suppose, I really struggle to, you can maybe, not that we should do it now, but I could be given concrete examples of them, you know, being, you know, behaving badly or whatever that I would be willing to entertain. But I think by and large, they all genuinely have good intentions, and they've been, to some or other degree, have probably been, I wouldn't even say lied to necessarily. It's more around the incentives. Like they've been presented with deeply insidious incentives that originate with financiers. And that's kind of part of what we talk about in the paper, that, or it's more like a conclusion of the paper, that we're trying to, you know, we don't want to call these people scammers. We don't want to call them shitcoiners. We want to appeal to them with reason and try to get them to come to Bitcoin, right? Like if they're extremely talented developers, which this is maybe another point of contention, I think a lot of them are, why build garbage, right? Or build on garbage, let's say. Again, I'm kind of repeating what we said earlier, but it's going to be harder. It's going to take longer, yada, yada, yada. There's no token payoff, whatever. But if your idea is worthwhile, it'll create more value here. So that's maybe one that I think I have this mental trade-off where most Bitcoiners, I think, just don't really like crypto people. Whereas I have the same, you know, total dislike, but I like shove it all into one corner. So I really, really dislike the financiers who are, I think, the source of it. And I kind of feel like everyone else is just either neutral or like maybe even a victim to some extent. And I want to appeal to them. I want to, you know, reason with them and try to be friends with them and try to pull them over here. Yeah, that's probably one. I'll mention one more. I don't know if you wanted how many answers you want to this or how long you want to spend on it. Just because it also ties with something we talked about previously. I think I could be mistaken about this, but my impression is there's this meme in Bitcoin that there just won't be any credit on a Bitcoin standard, like where, you know, like usury is evil, basically, and will be priced out or whatever. I don't know exactly how it would even be formulated, but I have some pretty involved thoughts on all the different ways there will still be credit. There'll just be way less. I think that's my take, but I've noticed this, that this comes up a lot. And I think it's unfortunate in a way, because it fits in with another point we've made about, let's call them fiat apologists again, when they're arguing, the origin of the argument may well be about deflation. But it then gets into all sorts of things, you know, capital accumulation, incentives to save, invest, blah, 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 that it actually gives them a bit of ammunition, I think, for no real reason, or no good reason, at least, because the fiat apologists will then pick up on this meme of, oh, there won't be any credit, and basically correctly, I think, say, well, correctly in that very limited context, say, okay, so finance is going to be highly dysfunctional. And then the Bitcoiners are kind of like, don't know what to say at that point. So I think it's kind of unfortunate, and I wish people would stop saying that. There would definitely be way less. Like, that's fine. We're all on board with that. But I don't think it'll be none.
Yeah, good point. I agree with that for sure. Cool, Alan. This was awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us. Is there anything
you want
to
thanks so much. I've had a great time.
Closing thoughts?
Yeah, closing thoughts. I don't know. Go read DLCVM, I guess. That would be one. Read it and see if you can tell it's a joke. That's all I've got. All right, well, more important, like, you do that in the meantime. But if you're listening to this after the paper I mentioned with Drew and Ryan has come out, maybe read that instead. It'll be more productive.
I like it. Well, thanks, Alan. This is great.
Yeah, thanks so much, Joe.